Das Internet ist für Sie nicht mehr als ein gesellschaftlich konstruiertes Konzept, das nichts darüber sagt, wie die Welt funktioniert. Was enthält dieses Konzept? Worin besteht für Sie die originäre Internettheorie ganz genau?
So let me start by saying that I do not deny the physicality of networks. I mean, there are networks, there are actual cables flowing into our homes, and there is probably something you can call the internet in that sense. So there is something physical and technical that you can call the internet. But that's only one of the many meanings with which we use this term in our public debate. And this is not the meaning with which I'm concerned. The meaning with which I'm concerned is the one that is often invoked by activists, by technology companies, by investors, when they make arguments about why, for example, certain laws need to pass or need not to pass. And they would often say things like, this law will break the internet, or this will go against the grain of the internet. Or they will say things like, our political system is incompatible with the internet. And what they mean by the internet in this particular case is not just this physical network. They mean some kind of social and political regime, right, which has emerged to be attached to this network. And what I'm arguing against is the very existence of this regime, or at least its natural existence. It hasn't emerged naturally. It is partly the product of assumptions that we make. One of those assumptions, for example, is that there is a sharp distinction between the virtual world in the real world.
Ich habe das auch ein bisschen so verstanden, dass Sie das Wort Internet, das Sie ja auch immer in Anführung setzen, für einen unbrauchbaren Begriff halten. Würden Sie alternativ einen anderen Begriff verwenden?
Well, I don't think that we need another word. And what's happening is that we tend to compress decades, and I would argue even centuries of technology history into just 2 decades that now we call the history of the internet. And we think that many of the developments that now we count as contemporary, for example, search engines, emerged solely from the context of the internet. And of course, they didn't. An idea like a search engine has its origins in a discipline like library science, information science, where all sorts of scholars for decades before the internet have been puzzling over questions of how to make knowledge easier to search and access. And people who founded Google were very much aware of those debates. But you see, what happens is that once we tend to use the internet, the idea of the internet, as the organizing metaphor for our technological debates, we tend to assume that somehow it was the internet that gave birth to Google, right? It was the internet that gave birth to social networking, right? And I think that this is the kind of simplification that we need to avoid. We have to understand that the world we currently live in does rely on technological infrastructure, does rely on networks, but many of those networks and many of the social and political logics that drive their development, they predate the internet. So an idea like big data, for example, which many think is a recent development, is not a recent development at all. Police departments, insurance companies, anti-terrorist organizations have been using databases and networks to make predictions about suspects, to preempt all sorts of subversive behavior for decades before the internet. And what happens is that once we have simplistic terms, one-word terms like the internet, all of that history is erased away, And we tend to think that the time we currently live in is far more unique and exceptional than it actually is.
Sie plädieren in Ihrem Buch für empirische Nüchternheit, schreiben Sie, die Sie dem Internetzentrismus und dem Solutionismus entgegenstellen wollen. Was genau würde man bei einem empirisch nüchternen Vorgehen denn anders machen als die Strömungen, die Sie kritisieren?
Sure. So one of the consequences was operating under an ideology like internet centrism is that it already frames a lot of questions for us before we even recognize the role that an idea like internet plays in our debate. So we tend to ask questions like, has social media contributed to the Arab Spring? Was the internet key in toppling dictators? Was the internet key in enabling surveillance, and so forth and so forth, right? And even those questions already code certain assumptions, or code for certain assumptions, about how technologies produce change. Essentially, we think that change happens because some technological development is driving it. So Twitter appears on the scene in Egypt, and suddenly all sorts of revolutionary processes start happening. And I don't think that that's at all what was happening in Egypt. And of course, if we start asking questions with this deterministic picture of technology appearing on the scene and serving as an agent of change, we are not likely to find that, you know, there are lots of complex social movements on the ground in Egypt, and all of them benefit from various technologies differently, and all of them use them to different advantages, and all of them start from very different power, you know, differentials at the very beginning. And so the appearance of technology will boost them to different degree, right? So it's like saying, imagine, I often like to give this example, imagine that all forces in a country like Egypt suddenly got access to money. So all of them got $1 billion to spend. You know, the Mubarak regime, the secular opposition, the Islamic opposition, the military state, everyone got $1 billion to spend. And let's now talk about the role of money. And you just wouldn't know what would happen. And you wouldn't know what would happen, not because you don't know anything about money, but you don't know about what opportunities they have to purchase surveillance equipment or to print leaflets or to build alliances. To understand all of that, you need to go and analyze empirically what is happening on the ground in Egypt. And then you might be able to figure out what the impact of this monetary infusion would be. It's not something that derives from some inherent qualities of money. And it's the same argument that I'm making essentially about the internet technology and social media. They have far fewer essential characteristics that are likely to pop up everywhere. That's not the case. There is no platonic idea of social media that carries the same features everywhere it goes. So when I call for more empiricism, it's trying to get away from this set of initial assumptions that we make, that media have certain characteristics, and those characteristics are likely to pop up and have certain effects that we already know before we have actually done any investigation. I just don't believe in that method of operation.
Etwas, was sich viele nicht vorstellen können, ist, dass es eine Zeit nach dem Internet geben könnte. Und Sie haben gesagt, man müsse das Innovationspotenzial vieler Plattformen und Techniken schon jetzt unter dem Gesichtspunkt betrachten, wie die in einer Post-Internet-Zeit nützlich sein könnten. Wie könnte so eine Post-Internet-Zeit aussehen?
Sure. Well, what I'm talking about when I write about post-internet mentality or disposition, if you will, it's that we need to find a way in which we can compare individual technologies based on how they contribute under existing historical, political, and economic conditions to various social projects that we find important or dear to our hearts, right? And I would argue that we need to do that for all of those projects individually and not under some general framework of the internet itself. So we need to go and understand how search engines are different from social networks and how social networks are different from, for example, peer-to-peer file sharing, or how you know, that is different from facial recognition. All of them have very different features. All of them would enable or disable certain emancipatory modes in our political regime. And we have to figure out how to compare them without clouding our thinking with ideas like the internet.
Sie stellen in Ihrem Buch auch fest, dass es immer eine gewisse Technikgläubigkeit gegeben hat und dass diese auch irgendwann wieder abebbt. Offenbar scheinen Sie dieser Erkenntnis aber gar nicht zu trauen, denn Sie bringen Ihre Kritik durchaus emotional und sehr ambitioniert vor. Woher kommt dieser Eifer? Was regt Sie so auf?
I mean, if you look at debates about technology and the economy so far, technology and the internet so far, what you would notice is that those debates operate very differently from debates about, say, art or politics or the economy, in that there is barely any disagreement between the leading protagonists. Mm-hmm. Everyone seems to be mildly supportive of each other, and it's as if there are no important ideas being exchanged. You know, everyone has their own favorite slogan, and they go and promote that slogan in a nice, you know, talk they deliver at the TED conference, and then they write a nice book, and then no one engages in critique. No one writes in this business. No one writes even negative reviews of each other's books. Before I sort of started doing it, that was completely off limits. Mm-hmm. Everyone was just celebrating another great new contribution to the world of ideas about technology and the internet. And I just think that this is ridiculous. You cannot have a robust debate about this one of the most important issues of the day when everything is approved by default as an interesting and useful idea. No, some of those ideas are far from interesting, and most of them are far from useful, and many of them are outright ugly and anti-democratic. Mm. And I have no problems stating that, but again, I have no problem stating that because that's how most other debates about important social issues operate. So in this sense, I have no problem with smuggling more and more emotions into this, in part because I think that's what this debate needs. So.
Sie nehmen sich auch einzelne Wissenschaftler sehr ausführlich vor, Jeff Jarvis zum Beispiel, Lawrence Lessig, David Weinberger und andere. Ich könnte noch mehr Beispiele aufzählen. Geht es diesen Wissenschaftlern tatsächlich um eine endgültige Lösung? Ist es nicht vielmehr ein Ausloten von Möglichkeitsräumen, etwa durch das Internet mehr Demokratie, mehr Austausch möglich zu machen? Ist die Kritik nicht vielleicht etwas überzogen?
Sure, I have no problem agreeing with that phrasing, but what you have to understand is that the way in which they claim to understand the world and the role of the internet in it is already suffused with all sorts of metaphysical assumptions about what the internet is and what it does, and that's part of my internet-centrism critique. I'm showing that, you know, they make certain assumptions about democracy or politics or participation, or they need to involve citizens, or the role of markets and how they think about it. At the very level of seemingly a political discussion about the internet, right? If you look at someone like Lawrence Lessig, he claims that his theory is all about law, and it's all about code, and it's all about technology. It sounds very objective. If you start actually digging deeper and understanding where he comes from intellectually, he comes from a particular intellectual position at the University of Chicago, which is very strongly rooted in neoliberal thought, and which is very strongly rooted in the so-called Chicago School of Economics. And with someone like Larry Lessig, a theory which is essentially a theory about putting more and more market relations into our everyday life is then presented as a fairly objective theory of the internet. And what I'm pointing out is that it's not at all a theory of the internet, it's a theory of something else, and we need to know what that something else is, and we can't just continue hiding under this label of the internet when the theories on offer are in fact deeply political and are not at all about technology or code. Mm.
Sie bringen auch sehr viele praktische Beispiele, wie das Internet zum Teil oder wie die Digitalisierung zum Teil skurrile Lösungen hervorbringt. Beispiel vorausschauende Verbrechensbekämpfung oder auch dieses Beispiel, wo der Mülleimer sozusagen untersucht wird, ob man auch den Müll ordentlich trennt und so weiter und machen sich große Sorgen, wohin das führen könnte. Ich habe mich nur gefragt, sehen Sie auch einen Unterschied zu Europa? Denn Europa beispielsweise ist, zumindest hier in Deutschland, geht auch viel skeptischer mit solchen Technologien um. Also man hat das Gefühl, dass die Leute vielleicht doch ein bisschen klüger sind, als sie vielleicht befürchten.
Again, if you frame those questions and issues around the issue of technology, you would probably reach that conclusion. But I don't think that that's the right way to frame those issues. When you think about some of the projects I discuss in the book, they, for example, revolve around the question of health. And it's about tapping into your smartphone, essentially, to monitor, you know, your diet or to monitor how much you exercise. And my suspicion is that politicians will have no choice but to eventually confront that issue through apps, in part because they are suddenly faced with problems like obesity, which are as much of a problem now in Europe, or at least becoming so, as they are in the US. If you look at a country like Britain, for example, there is a very vibrant discourse, much more vibrant than in America, about the idea of nudging and the idea of using behavioral economics to influence the behavior of citizens when it comes to issues like recycling or issues like exercise or issues like dieting. And technology here is instrumental to advancing an agenda that, again, is not at all about technology. It's about solving big, important social problems by essentially offloading solutions to citizens. And here, what you need to figure out is the extent to which European governments would be susceptible to such neoliberal interventions. And so far, they seem to be quite susceptible to them. The fact that the policymakers haven't yet figured out how to do that doesn't mean that they're smarter. It actually means the opposite. But it doesn't mean that they wouldn't smarten up. And this is the alliance between Silicon Valley and the technocrats, with citizens somehow, you know, being actually not that disfavorable to many of those projects. They would think that, well, great, if I can have an app on my phone that will allow me to stay slimmer, great, I'll take it. Right? That doesn't necessarily solve the big issues that exist with regards to problems like obesity. It doesn't do anything about regulating the food companies. It doesn't do anything about regulating how we advertise junk food to children. It doesn't do anything in terms of promoting infrastructure where you can actually walk and exercise. There are all sorts of other structural solutions that are being pushed out as we embrace this new technologically friendly way of tackling the crisis. Mm-hmm. And my concern is that for most politicians who find themselves under conditions of austerity, that's the right way to solve problems. Because, hey, it's shiny, it promotes innovation, it makes us look cool because we're all dealing with Silicon Valley, and it doesn't require any effort, because ultimately all problems can be tackled by citizens.
Und Sie glauben, die Leute kriegen das nicht mit, weil es so subtil abläuft?
I mean, people don't notice. People do notice, but people accept this new reality as completely normal. I mean, look, it used to be that you'd go to a travel agency to book your flight, and, you know, it will be very nice, and now it's all getting disintermediated, and you have to take on more and more tasks. You have to book it yourself. You have to check in yourself. You have to do everything yourself. You have to pay for your luggage. And, you know, you understand that probably your experience of traveling is getting inferior. But, you know, where's the protest, right? I mean, so again, you have to understand at the structural level how changes in our mentality, how we think about institutions, deinstitutionalization, disintermediation, to use all of those fancy words that people in Silicon Valley like, how they have become so deeply embedded in how we think about the world that now people find it perfectly acceptable that, you know, perhaps you no longer need to go to university as long as you can stay at home and learn all the skills by watching online videos, right? And that's the vision, again, that Silicon Valley promotes, because they think that education exists not to generate research, but simply to, you know, spread around marketable skills. So you need to know how to build a spreadsheet. And yes, you'll learn how to build a spreadsheet by watching an online video. I mean, that would not do anything to subsidize the work of someone working on literature in ancient Greece, right? Mm. And that's why partly we need education, right? It's a very complex process where one department subsidizes another and lots of complex outputs come in the end. Silicon Valley doesn't know this, and frankly, they don't care. So they keep producing the solutions that the market demands, And politicians opt for them because, you know, we have a market-conformed democracy, as the chancellor told us.